On January 24, 2019, former U.S. Ambassador Mark Johnson, diplomat in Egypt, Iran, Kuwait, and the Persian Gulf, gave a lecture in the Hager Auditorium at the Museum of the Rockies entitled, "The U.S. and the Middle East, How We Got to This Point, Understanding the Hard Lessons of 1979. Ambassador Johnson is a fourth-generation Montanan. He established the Montana World Affairs Council in 2000 with the goal of providing Montanans with greater opportunities to understand the world.
Good evening to all of you, and thank you, Jenna, for that wonderful introduction. Really, what I am is a recovering bureaucrat, so we'll leave it at that. See, I always ask because I used to give speeches in Africa, and I learned that the best talks I ever gave were the ones where the power went out, and nobody heard a word what I said. Though it could have been the fact I was speaking in my miserable French. But anyway, you have no excuse tonight. So first and foremost, I want to thank the Museum of the Rockies for letting us use this splendid facility. You folks are so lucky. This really is the crown jewel of Montana, and it's a real pleasure to be here. Tonight, I'm going to attempt, I suppose I should say, to discuss developments in the Middle East from the standpoint of how the U.S. came to find itself in a position it is in today. And I'll refer to them as the hard lessons of 1975. Of course, I could have said how the United States came to find itself in the mess it's in, but I'll leave that to you. So I have been involved with the region for about 50 years, not quite. I worked there as a diplomat, places like Iran, Egypt, the Persian Gulf, etc. When I retired and came back to Montana, I taught about the Middle East at the University of Montana. My wife and I lead tours back to the region at least once a year. And so the more I look at the Middle East, I've come to one conclusion. The reason God created all the wars in the Middle East was simply so that Americans would study geography, right? I can't think of any other reason. So whenever I talk about this region, there are two points that I insist on making. The first is, and I'll illustrate it with a map, it is this region that you see behind me, the greater Middle East, that will determine the success or failure of the Trump administration foreign policy. That's not a political statement. It is a statement of fact. You could consult with the administrations of George W. Bush or Jimmy Carter and see how the Middle East treated their administrations. Now, the second point, and to be honest, it's the only one I hope you will remember. Middle East is many things, camels, sand, oil, you name it. But above all, it's about the people. And the people are wonderful. They are warm and welcoming across the region. We've never had a problem, as many people might imagine. So my point is, don't demonize the people. They are living lives of hell. You may certainly demonize the regimes that made this all possible. Now, to begin with, before I delve in a little more of the substance, we'll start with just some basic overall facts. Divide it kind of into two parts. First, the members of the Arab League, which extend from Algeria all the way down to Oman and Yemen, 22 members of the Arab League are informed by the language Arabic, not by the religion Islam. After all, there are Arab Baptists and Arab Jews and so forth. Together, roughly, these countries have the same population as the United States and about the same landmass as the United States. But, as you're aware, there are two other countries we have to add. One is Israel. You're aware of Israel, the Jewish state. The other one is Iran. Now, Iran is not an Arab country. There's no quicker way to insult a Persian, he or she, by referring to them as an Arab. I quote for you the great lyric poet, the Persian poet Ferdowsi, who once said, "Damn on this place, damn on this time, that fate has brought these uncivilized lizard eaters to our land." I think you get the point, right? So, That is the basic. Now, so Israel, and a final country that I will talk about is Afghanistan. A different linguistic and historical narrative, as is Iran. But nevertheless, for the purpose of this discussion, I'm going to include it into this region. So basically, this area, talking about the Middle East, the Arab part, contains about, I would say, 40 to 50% of the world's petroleum reserves, and yet it only contains about 1% of the water. And as the late King Hussein of Jordan said once, the next major war in the Middle East will be fought over water. And I believe he was completely accurate on that score. So that is looking broadly at it, some of the highlights of the region. I also want to point out some of the major strategic areas. Here we have the Straits of Hormuz here with sea lanes of only about 2.5 miles each. Through that body of water, it's much narrower than the map would suggest. Through that body of water, you will see 17 million barrels of oil move a day. Imagine if that strait was blocked. Secondly, we have the Indian Ocean along here, which is a vital lane of commerce. We go into the Red Sea right now and then come out with the Suez Canal here, right here. And through the canal, about 18,000 ships a year move. So as you can see, there is some real strategic interest and importance here. Oftentimes people come to me and they say, why are we worried? Why do we spend so much time on the Middle East? Give me a break. Can't we turn the page? Can't we put it behind us? What's interesting about that, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing, but what is interesting, most Americans are quite surprised to learn that the U.S. has had a very long engagement with the Middle East. In fact, I will suggest to you, it was the Middle East that made the United States the United States. That came about in the administrations of Washington, Adams, and Jefferson. The new country needed trade. They needed to earn money because after the Revolutionary War, they had something like $20 to $40 million in debt. So these ships would go forth. When we said in 1776, we do in terms of declaring our independence, Great Britain said, we don't, meaning they would no longer provide maritime protection. And so these ships along the northern coast of the Mediterranean here, today's Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, and so forth, were seized by the rulers of these countries. And the sailors were taken, impressed, put into slavery almost. The United States had no national navy. It had no chief executive officer, if you will. In fact, the inability to respond was something George Washington referred to as our greatest disgrace, all right? And now, about the same time as the Barbary pirates were active, 1780s, 1790s, a little bit after, another major impulse happened, and that was two missionaries set sail from the Old South Church, and they were headed for the Holy Land, for Jerusalem. And they would become known as the Restorationists, trying to restore the biblical conditions necessary to hasten the return of the Redeemer. Now, these are very real, and those impulses, as I call them, are with us to this very day. So as much as I might like from time to time to say, oh my gosh, can't we just move on? That's a favorite American expression. Let's just move on. The Middle East won't let us move on. George W. Bush tried to move on. He got 9/11. I don't know what we're going to get now, but it doesn't look good. So those are the two, what I call the main impulses. If you're political science, which I'm not, you might refer to them as the school of realism or the school of idealism, all right? Now I want to talk I want to focus a little more sharply to try and understand, okay, how are the main contours of the Middle East when we talk about it today? And there are two events that happened in the aftermath, at the end of the Second World War and in its aftermath. Here you have a picture. On the right is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In the middle was King Abdulaziz ibn Saud, the founder and the monarch, the leader of Saudi Arabia. The man kneeling is a very interesting character. He was born of missionary parents in Lebanon. His Arabic was fluent, and you can see the king is engaging with him. This meeting, which was the first time a president and the head of Saudi Arabia had met, surely had everything to do about oil, right? Let's not kid ourselves. Everything. Because in World War II, the Allies had used about 100 times more petroleum than they had in World War I. So a reliable supply of oil was vital to our national security. The other thing was that Roosevelt was seeking to enlist the support of the king as a bulwark against what was looming communist expansion into this region. In fact, Roosevelt would write to the king saying, "I cannot imagine of any threat to your kingdom that would not be of immediate concern to us." Then Truman, Roosevelt will die about 8 weeks after this picture was taken. Then Truman said, very direct pointed language, "We stand with you in your fight against the godless forces of atheism." Now hold on to that thought. It'll come back, and I want to use it to make another point. All right, so this was one of the main contours, 1945, the meeting in the Great Bitter Lake of the Suez Canal. Now the next event you're a little more familiar with, the establishment of the State of Israel. And that took place on May 14th, 1948. 6 minutes after the new State of Israel was declared, the United States conferred official diplomatic recognition. Now, I brought this letter. The letter, the first version said, "We recognize the government thereof." The United States recognizes the provisional government. And instead of saying of the Jewish arrangement, it says of the State of Israel. You probably can't make that out, but those are Truman's words that he wrote in. That's important even to this day, because we currently have a prime minister in Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, who insists that Israel be recognized as the Jewish state. Truman was correct in calling it the State of Israel. Okay, so those I would call the two basic contours of American engagement. Now we're going to drill down even more closely and see how in the world did we get to this point where we're at today. So, and I refer now to the hard lessons of 1979. They all occurred amazingly in 1 year, and they very much have established and dictated our involvement with this region. First, chronologically, January of 79, about 40 years ago, more than 40 years ago, there was a revolution, and it overthrew a monarch, a king, a Shah named Pahlavi, the Shah of Iran. And you see, this crowd was one of the largest in history. I was in the streets of Tehran a few months after that, so I could feel the pulse of this, and the pictures that you see are those of the founder of the Islamic revolution, a charismatic clergyman named Ayatollah, which is a religious title, Khomeini. And here I need to just divert a minute and give you a brief overview. We talk about two forms of Islam, right? When the Prophet Muhammad died in the 7th century, there was a great consternation, a great commotion as to who would replace him. One school of thought said it has to be a wise and righteous member from the community, and they became known as the communitarians, or the Muwahhidun in Arabic, or today they're known as the Sunni. All right? The second group, the second body of thought said, no, it has to be a blood relative or a family member of the Prophet. And they looked at a man named Ali. Ali was the cousin and son-in-law of the Prophet. They are now known as the partisans of Ali, the supporters of Ali, or we refer to them as the Shia. So you have Sunnis and Shia. This will be woven into the talk, so it's good to get a little bit of perspective. Khomeini did three things, basically. He abolished the monarchy. The Shah was perceived as very cruel, very corrupt, and in it, Khomeini established a new kind of government called an Islamic Republic with a supreme leader, never been seen before. And the supreme leader had supreme power. He controlled the military, controlled the judiciary, the press, and that has endured very much to this day. Now, the second part of the revolution, equally significant, is that Khomeini said, our form of Islam, Shia Islam, must be spread as the vanguard of revolutionary Islam. And that was a very powerful message. And it led in November to another situation that I was very much involved with, in fact, directly involved with, and that was the seizure of the hostages. They're climbing a wall in the U.S. Embassy in downtown Tehran. Incidentally, for those of you who saw the movie Argo, right, kind of vaguely remember, cast your eye, you can't see it here, but keep going to the left, there was a side street. Down there was some embassy facilities, consular facilities and so forth. The six Americans who were were not part of the original takeover decided to make a break for it. They made their way to this side street. And what they did, it's always amazed me, instead of turning left, which would have taken them into the arms of this group, they turned right, where they remained at liberty, and the Canadian government, in something I will never forget, took them in. I had met one of the guys at the Canadian embassy, and when the six guys fleeing called him, he said, this Canadian diplomat, he said, well, what took you so long, eh? So the hostage crisis, I want to share a story with you to try attempt to portray what was going on. In 2010, my wife and I were going into Tehran. We were going to lead a group, Americans, with the National World Affairs Council, okay? And sitting next to us was a gentleman, an Iranian, international engineer, as I recall, and he could tell we were Americans. His English was quite good. And so he struck up a conversation. He said, you know, in early November, a group of my friends who were engineering students called me and said, we want you to join us in a sit-in at the U.S. Embassy. A sit-in, which has always made me think some of them must have done work at Berkeley, but that's another story. He said, our friend next to us, I can't. I've got a big exam. I've got to study. They said, don't worry, it's going to be over in 2 or 3 days. And that was the plan. They wanted to make a statement, have a sit-in, and then disperse. But when Ayatollah Khomeini, whose picture I just showed you, found out about it, he said, aha, this is the second revolution. What he meant was, at that point, there was so much hostility towards Americans, part of the reasons why the revolution occurred, and outsiders. He said, this will be the second revolution. And then what he did, and I think it was a brilliant move, he took that feeling, which I saw for myself when I was in Tehran, and he channeled it to his side of the revolution. It was not clear at that point that the Islamic version would win out. But once Khomeini had this mood on his side, it was a foregone conclusion from that point on that there would be an Islamic Republic. Now, Iran today is the dominant power in the region from western Afghanistan all the way across to the Mediterranean, going through Iraq and Lebanon and so forth. Internally, it has problems. The economy is in dire straits. The U.S. reimposed sanctions that had been lifted as part of the 2015 nuclear deal. Also, Iran suffers from massive corruption and incompetence. So, and this anti-American feeling from the official level, let me get back to that, from the official level, endures. In fact, the way I put it is, anti-Americanism is the oxygen that the regime uses to breathe. Now, when we were there, We've been there on three or four. I've been back maybe six or seven times. The people we encountered, the average Iranians, they didn't have this hostility. Now, I don't know about now, all right? But they wanted to get on with life. But as far as the regime is concerned, what I'm telling you is don't hold your breath for any improvement in U.S.-Iranian relations, all right? Now, the next thing that happened, this would be in March of 79. It was a good thing at the time. It still is a good thing, although it's rather fragile. The Camp David Peace Accord. Maybe you may remember that. Here you have on the right, Prime Minister Menachem Begin, on the left, Anwar Sadat, in the middle, Jimmy Carter. Now, I have to tell you something. You see smiles? Don't buy it. These two guys hated each other. They hated each other. In fact, the first time Carter was able to get him into a room at Camp David in the mountains outside of Washington, the meeting went so badly with these two guys, both advisors from both sides called and said, don't ever do that again. These guys just loathe each other. But my point is this. They had another motive in mind. They had something else they wanted to achieve. For Sadat, on the left, it was to remove wars with Israel, wars which Egypt couldn't win, from the battlefield, and let Egypt move on with its economic, social, and political development. Menachem Begin reasoned, and correctly I think, that if he could take Egypt out of the battlefield, then Israel's chances for peace would be greatly increased. He called it his capsulate theory. So the two of these guys showed great leadership. That's the point I want to make. Great leadership does not exist today in the Middle East. The way I used to describe this situation is Begin and Sadat liked each other this much. You see that up there? They liked peace that much. I always thought that was a good way of doing it until I was on a radio interview, so apparently it fell a little flat. So today, where are we? The so-called peace process is in a deep coma. The chances of it being revived, I am doubtful of. Both leaders, Palestine and Israel, are in a weakened position. Mahmoud Abbas has rivalries. He has poor health. Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister, is facing serious legal charges and possible indictments for embezzlement and or corruption. So there's not going to be any incentive. The United States has announced that it has the deal of the century to bring peace to this region. Here's a little clue. My optimism is under control. All right? So I don't think that's going to happen. But again, these guys hated each other. They saw a common good, and they managed to work through it and resolve it. That's, I always, when I used to teach at the university, I would say, this is the power of leadership. All right? Now, the next picture, I suspect, will grab your attention. That is Saddam Hussein, the ruler of Iraq. Saddam emerged in the summer of 79 out of the rough and tumble politics of Iraq, and he rose to the top as the president. Now, you remember, it's funny, a little funny aside here, George Bush Sr. used to always refer to him as Saddam. Some of you of an age will remember that. Saddam, this will not stand, after the Iraqis invaded Kuwait. Now, I've never been sure if that was Bush himself or Dana Carvey on Saturday Night Live, but we do know that Saddam hated it when he was captured in the debriefings. We got a measure of Saddam's brutality very quickly. He undertook a very bloody purge of party officials, number one, and number two, he launched a really disastrous war against Iran, the Iran-Iraq War in 1980 that endured through 1988, in which there were, oh, I would say 500,000 casualties on each side. That's how bloody it was. Saddam, though, was important for three reasons. First, he was emblematic. He was the poster child for the strongman, authoritarian, iron-fisted ruler that unfortunately still exists in the Arab world. The second thing that he revealed was the intense inter-Arab rivalries. Now, Sadat, after this peace agreement, Egypt was condemned and ostracized and thrown out of the Arab League. And in fact, that decision was taken in Baghdad because Saddam saw himself as the new leader of the Arab world, much like the great Arab nationalist Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt. And this, the other thing that Saddam pointed out, drove home, illustrated, was the depth of the hostility between the Shia and the Sunnis. Okay? Saddam was captured, oh, I think it was about 2003. It was later than that, but he was tried and sentenced to death by hanging. And I want to share with you what happened in his last moments, his last words. I know this because there was a New York Times reporter. Saddam walked up the stairs. He was very shaken and ashen. And there was a crowd in the room of Shia. He was Sunni. And they began to taunt him, to chant. And the old fiery, blustery Saddam came back. And just before the door opened, he said, "Death to outsiders, death to the Americans, and death to Persians." Now the question is, was he referring to just the Iran-Iraq War of 1980? It's possible, even though he started it. But they have very, very long memories in the Middle East. Was he referring to something that happened in 1258? You all know that, so I guess I don't need to explain that. Something in 1258, the Mongols came in from Asia, Central Asia, and sacked Baghdad, priceless art, architecture, literature, and everything, center of civilization, let us say. It is said, and I think there's some historical proof for this, it is said that the guy who opened the gates to let the Mongols come in was a man named Algomi. Who is Algomi? Algomi was a Shia. He was a Persian. And as I said, they have very long memories in this part of the world. And that tension is now very much more visible. So the final lesson of 1979, the hard lesson, the perfect storm occurs on Christmas Eve, 1979. The next event occurred 2.5 weeks after the hostages were seized. And it took place in Mecca, the Grand Mosque. You can see the towers there. The Hajj, the pilgrimage, one of the pillars of Islam that all Muslims are obliged to follow if they can, was unfolding. And on the morning of November 20th, a group of about 200 men entered the gates. Nothing unusual. Thousands would stream into this central courtyard. And most of them were Saudis, some Egyptians. And I've learned that there are two Americans whose identity has never been revealed, to my knowledge. There is a tradition in Mecca at the Hajj that if you bring in a coffin or a body, it can be blessed, a special blessing, I believe, and that will hasten the journey of that soul to heaven. Well, these guys brought a coffin in, the perpetrators. But instead of a cadaver, it had Kalashnikov rifles, hand grenades, RPGs, and they started shooting randomly at the people inside the courtyard, killing dozens. They then barricaded the gates, and then they took to the microphones at the Grand Mosque and began to chant things. The House of Saud, the House of Saud is illegal. The House of Saud is an agent of Satan. The House of Saud must be replaced. Now, obviously, these are stunning, stunning words. The government of Saudi Arabia was, frankly, stunned. This has never happened. Well, yeah, it never happened to this magnitude. And they were paralyzed. They didn't know what to do. Meanwhile, the perpetrators had fled down underneath. There's a labyrinthic tunnels underneath the main courtyard, and they barricaded themselves and were hiding out. Fortunately for the Saudis, construction work was being done on the Grand Mosque by a construction firm whose name may be familiar, the Bin Laden Construction Firm. The father of Osama Bin Laden was doing that. Okay, Osama, father and son were to split irreparably not long after that. So what came out of this affair are two things that are very much with us today. The first was that the Saudis made a deal with the devil. And the deal was, after they had executed the main ringleaders, they said, okay, the rest of you get lost. Get out of the kingdom. Do not ever come back. Leave us, the Saudis, alone to do our thing. And you go off and do your own thing. Now, the interesting part of that is, where did they go? They went to Pakistan. And why Pakistan? Because it had a new president who was Zia-ul-Huq, who was attempting to establish a radical Islamic government there. This partly explains why Pakistan has been a difficult country to deal with. But the Saudis did something else. They said, our version of Islam, Sunni Islam, will be the vanguard for spreading radical Islam throughout the Middle East. Now, if you've been following, you already know this was said about something else, the Iranians and the Persians. So the stage is set for this dramatic tension and cold war, in effect, between the Persians and the Arabs, the Sunnis and the Shias. So now we come to our last event. This takes place on Christmas Eve, 1979. A perfect storm unfolds. The Soviets invade Afghanistan. And the purpose was to move into Afghanistan, set up a puppet government, communist government. Moscow was worried about the possibility of declining influence in this key region, and so they went in and did establish a new government. And at first, in the White House, we were all working at that time head over heels on the hostages. So yeah, we knew about it, but we were not focused on it. We trying to secure the release of our hostages. But in the White House, there was a different reaction. Carter, and his national security advisors, the big dude Brzezinski, were in a way almost gleeful. That's probably a mischaracterization. But they saw this as an opportunity to drive a final nail in the coffin of the Soviet Union. Or as it was said, Afghanistan could be the Soviets, as Vietnam was to the Americans. And so they formed a plan between the U.S., Pakistan, and the Saudis. The U.S. would provide sophisticated weapons, namely Stinger missiles, which were effective in shooting down Soviet helicopters. The Saudis would provide money, obviously, they had a lot of it, and they would help recruit volunteers, the Mujahideen, to come and fight. Pakistanis would provide seasoned veteran military officers and other kinds of military equipment. So the question is, what could possibly go wrong here? Or if you've ever seen the movie Charlie Wilson's War, the character who plays the CIA agent, I think it's Philip Seymour Hoffman, says something, do we know what we're getting into? And the answer was, doesn't seem like it in the historical aftermath. So the Soviets eventually had to leave 10 years later, 1989. The United States and other allies saw this as a victory in the Cold War. And what I told you just now about the partnership between the U.S., the Saudis, and the Pakistanis, now you recall the language of Truman's letter. We stand with you in your fight against the godless forces. But things started to happen after the Soviets left. A rise of terrorist attacks occurred. In 2003, there was a bombing, attempted bombing of the trade towers, the trade center, the world towers, There was an attempted assassination, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Things started to develop. There was something going on. Finally, in 1996, the FBI sent two agents to go to an American military base in Germany. And there they would interview a man named Jamal al-Fadl. Kind of an interesting footnote to history. Fadl had been an assistant, a gopher, personal secretary, you might call him, to bin Laden. But al-Fadl got greedy, and he tried to steal $100,000. He was found out. He was on the run. His life was in dire jeopardy. So he went to a U.S. embassy, and he said, look, I'm going to make a deal with you. If you can give me safe haven in the United States, I can reveal some details about a new organization. And what he did from that point was to provide in chilling detail, really, facts about the existence of this group called the base, or in Arabic, Al-Qaeda. And a footnote to this particular story that I like to share, something then happened that probably could occur only in the United States. Jamal al-Fadl was relocated in the United States, and he won the New Jersey State Lottery. Is it a great country or what? So those, ladies and gentlemen, are the hard lessons, and perhaps I've abbreviated them or summarized them a little too much. Let me do what they always say in Washington. Let's connect the dots. What came out of this? And what I take away from this are three things. First, out of this comes the development, the birth, really, of modern global jihadi terrorism. Now, terrorism has been around for a long time, but I'm talking about as practiced by the likes of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. ISIS and Al-Qaeda split in 2014. Simply, I would point out, despite the fact that there was an announcement from the White House on December 19th that ISIS had been defeated, I've done some research. Since that date, there have been 28 separate and distinct ISIS attacks in both Syria and Iraq. The bigger point I want to make is that ISIS has rebranded itself. They're agile. They're going underground as a classic insurgency, eschewing these formal, big-scale terrorism activities. But they ain't dead, all right? The second thing that emerged is Islamism. Let's be careful with that word. I'm not talking about the religion of Islam. I'm talking about the ideology of Islam. Emerges as a legitimate narrative, if you will, ideology, and replaces pan-Arabism, nationalism, leftist, communist, and so forth. There's a real tension going on within the Islamic world between the reformers, which is probably a clumsy word, and the hardcore jihadists. And the way I look at it is Islam today is in its 14th century, all right? And you have this split occurring. I'm not a theologian, obviously, nor am I a historian, but it occurs to me that in its 14th century, Christianity was undergoing the same thing, right? With the Reformation and the Inquisition and all of that. So it's interesting to think about. Now, finally, what about the United States? What have they been doing? Well, usually at this point in this kind of lecture, I stop and I quote something from Winston Churchill. I love quotes from Winston Churchill. However, I'm not really sure 100% that he actually said this, but it's a good quote. The United States can always be counted on to do the right thing after it has exhausted every other option. Or as Otto von Bismarck of Germany said many, many years before, there is a special God that looks after drunks, fools, idiots, and the United States of America. Well, I certainly hope so. Somebody's looking out for them. So what comes out of this, I think you can sort of begin to piece together how we got to this point. It will take, I think, continued engagement before any of these situations can be brought under control. So those are the hard lessons of 1979 and the impact that they've had on the U.S. And this is an attempt to discuss how we got to the point we are in today. All right, and not precise, not perfect, but maybe it gives you a framework to consider events. So with that, I want to be sure and thank you all again for coming out to this program tonight. It means a lot for us at the World Affairs Council of Montana to be able to come to your community, and especially in this splendid facility, and talk to you about a lighthearted and whimsical topic like the Middle East. So with that, I'm going to stop, and I think we have some time for questions.
I think you did a superb job of telling us in a most entertaining way.
But
things that happened in 1979.
Yeah.
But I need some sort of summary to understand how all of this goes together to account for why we're in the mess we are now.
Yeah. No, that's a good question. And I could be glib and say I don't have a clue, but that's not fair. The United States has a bad habit when it deals with the Middle East. Any of you have been to the Middle East, you bought a carpet or brass, you know you have to bargain, negotiate, haggle in the markets or the souks, except for the U.S. Because when it comes to the Middle East, the U.S. always and only pays retail. Let me give you an example. Let's go back to the Barbary Pirates. At the very early time of our country, the ruler of Algeria demanded $60,000 in ransom money to free the hostages. The U.S., again, for the reasons I mentioned, couldn't get its act together. So the offer was renewed in 1797, and I just said $60,000, right? Here was the price. $992,463.25. So as I said, retail. Or if you like, you can pay me now or you can pay me later, but you will pay. So the problem is, what interconnecting thought or connects all of this so we can make sense of it? I don't think there is a way to connect this all together. Well, one way I would put it to you is this. Do you know what the most dangerous word in the Middle East is? Vacuum. Vacuum. If there is nothing there, we're going to leave this place. Turn the page. Turn the lights off. Get out of here. Good. Good. Something will fill it. We left Afghanistan once. What did we get? Taliban. We left it again. We got Al-Qaeda. Now we've got all three of them, including ISIS. You know, the Taliban had a funny way, have a funny way of describing it. After, in 2007, the surge of about 30,000 troops, and the Taliban actually said something I thought was kind of funny. They said, "You Americans, you have all the fancy wristwatches, but we Taliban have all the time." That's our greatest enemy right now. We're impatient. We want to get over with. Let's put it behind us. And the Middle East knows that. And I think it's a particularly dangerous time in the region. The absence of there are no Sadats or Begins. You know, there are no Nelson Mandelas, as we saw in South Africa. Now, if you want to elaborate a little more on your question, maybe I'll do a better job. And many people will point to the British. There was a period of time, 1905, where the British said to the Palestinians, "Work with us at that time in expelling the Ottomans, and we'll give you a homeland in Palestine, you, the Israelis." And then that was changed. I mean, that we will give the Arabs a homeland. Then a few years later, another declaration, work with us, said the British, I will give you a homeland, right, in what is today Palestine. And so the Arabs have a funny way of putting it. Whenever they would hear the phrase, the sun never sets on the British Empire, you're familiar with that, sun never sets, the Arabs would say, yeah, that's right, because God wouldn't trust them at night. But the Sykes-Picot Agreement has been a festering sore. I think there's more to it than that. I think something would have happened, would have come out of that. But the arbitrary nature and the fact, it reminds me a little bit when I served in Africa, the big continent of Africa. The colonial powers went into Africa, and this is somewhat, I think, relevant to the Middle East, went in to the region. Look at this region in West Africa. See how the lines are drawn arbitrarily, into countries. But the problem is the tribes are displayed this way. So they divided and set up these artificial states and in a way encouraged the emergence of strong-willed leaders, strongmen, dictators, who could muscle their way into power. So we're going to live with that. I don't think that with regard to the Sykes-Picot and the aftermath, that it's not going to get any better.
I have two questions. One, would you comment on where you see the future with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia? And the other one, would you comment on, well, I perceive that the U.S. abandons the Kurds,
yeah,
and have historically abandoned,
yeah,
the Kurds when the Kurds step forward to help us.
Well, that's true.
And I think we're doing that again.
I think we are. I think. Well, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, young 30-something, impetuous, headstrong leader who was appointed by his king and upset a long tradition of how crown princes are chosen and appointed. The crown prince has taken Saudi Arabia from one blunder to another. They attempted to kidnap the prime minister of Lebanon. They launched this disastrous invasion of Yemen in 2015. He even called in the 200 leading members of the royal family and business community and had a massive shakedown to get their assets. I think what I'm saying is, watch out. And there's a reason why this young man sleeps on a yacht outside of Jeddah in the Red Sea, because he knows at some point his life will come under threat. Again, they have long memories, and he has collided with other branches of the royal family. And I don't think that's, I mean, the bottom line is Saudi Arabia, you could say, is at its least stable point in the last 50 years. And somebody's going to have to pay a price for that. And that somebody is MBS. All right? Now, the Kurds have been abandoned and betrayed so many times, it's hard to, it's hard to keep count. Certainly the decision to pull out of Syria was done without any consultation, without any information, any facts, and it places the Kurds at great jeopardy. Now, what will the Kurds do? They'll make a deal. They'll live to fight another day. Might they ally themselves with the remnants of ISIS? They might. You know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and survival is everything. We don't think these things through. We don't think them through, and they're very, very, they're not necessarily complicated, but you have to get the moving pieces together. So that would be my take on that. Yes, last question, sir.
You mentioned about the vacuum principle.
Yeah.
And in Syria, that's no more, can't be more true than anywhere else.
Right.
What is your perspective on solutions? I work with Syrian refugees in that region. What's your perspective on any solution?
Oh, solution? Well, again, that's a really tough one, a really hard question. The Middle East, because of the dynamics that I have talked about, there's no point in being a moderate in Syria. because you're going to be outgunned. As Tom Friedman once said in a New York Times editorial, yeah, these guys that tweet, tweet, bang, bang beats tweet, tweet. So sheer power will beat these efforts. And that was the sadness of the Arab uprising in 2011. These people, brave as they were, could confront, but they couldn't construct, okay? They couldn't construct, they couldn't fashion an alternative. They couldn't fashion, I mean, much as Sadat and Begin did. That's the model. They couldn't do that. And there's no percentage. I mean, there's another saying in the Middle East, maybe more apt, two people, one grave. Ain't gonna be me. So that, I think, is the animating force, the driving force in this jungle, really. And the United States has allies, it has influence, but to abandon it, as we seem to want to do, I think you get the hint of how I feel about that. But it's tough. It's tough. It's hard. It's hard to stay engaged with the Middle East when you look at everything and you see how badly it seems to be going. All right? So I think that's about as good as I can do with that question. Thank you for it, though. It was very good. All right. Drive safely, everybody. Thank you again for coming out tonight. And we hope World Affairs Council is going to do programs like this in the future.
You have just heard a talk by former U.S. Ambassador Mark Johnson, diplomat in Egypt, Iran, Kuwait, and the Persian Gulf, recorded at the Hager Auditorium of the Museum of the Rockies on January 24, 2019, entitled "The U.S. and the Middle East: How We Got to This Point, Understanding the Hard Lessons of 1979. Ambassador Johnson is a fourth-generation Montanan. He established the Montana World Affairs Council in 2000 with the goal of providing Montanans with greater opportunities to understand the world. To find out more about the Montana World Affairs Council, you can go to their website, montanaworldaffairs.org. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LeClaire for KGVM 95.9 FM, Gallatin Valley Community Radio, and archived at kgvm.org.